Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Friday, September 22nd, and I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast first thing. This forecast comes to us from KCRG-TV, and it is titled, Plenty of Clouds with Storm Chances Increasing Later Friday. An active few days are ahead for eastern Iowa, with a handful of shower and storm chances. Some areas of patchy fog are possible early Friday, with early reports favoring southern Iowa for that potential. Be prepared for changing visibility conditions underneath otherwise cloudy skies. We'll be waiting on a mid-level disturbance to move out of eastern Nebraska and across the state throughout the day. As it does, the chance for showers and storms increases by afternoon into the evening. This could potentially affect Friday night high school football games, so be prepared for that if you have plans to attend one tonight. Highs will be held back a bit today by cloud cover, likely in the low to mid-70s. Scattered storms could linger tonight, but will tend to move out of the area early on Saturday. This gives us a bit of a break during the day, though we can't rule out isolated shower or storm development at times on Saturday. Most will stay dry for a little while, and temperatures will get a chance to get to the upper 70s and low 80s, with some breaks in the clouds on Saturday. By Saturday evening and night, showers and storms that develop to our west will be moving into the area. Some of these storms could initially be strong or even severe in our far western counties, with damaging wind and large hail the main threats. Due to the time of day, will likely be weaker as they move through more of the area overnight. Still, a good chance for some decent rainfall begins during this time. That chance extends into Sunday, too, with additional showers and storms possible. Due to the widespread cloud cover and rainfall, highs will likely be held back into the upper 60s and low 70s. It'll be windy at times, too, from Saturday into Sunday. Rainfall totals are still looking healthy overall, with amounts ranging from half an inch to 2 inches in spots. If you receive more than one round of storms over the next few days, you're most likely to see those higher totals. Some showers may linger on Monday, but drier weather looks possible for the rest of the 9-day forecast. Temperatures will generally be in the upper 60s to lower 70s for highs for a few days, and upper 40s to lower 50s for the lows. A modest warming trend is possible toward the end of the work week into the upper 70s. Now turning to the front page of the Courier, the lead article is titled, Slain Officer Honored, Funeral for Kevin Cram, 33, filled with remembrances of his life. The story came from the Globe Gazette journalist Matthew Rizab. Dateline Algona. The entire gymnasium and cafeteria at Algona High School were packed with hundreds of mourners for fallen officer Kevin Cram on Wednesday. He was remembered as a loving father, husband, fantastic police officer, and a great friend by friends and colleagues. Cram was killed just before 8 p.m. on September 13th as he tried to serve an arrest warrant to 43-year-old Kyle Rickey. Cram, a 33-year-old husband and father of three, who had been an officer in Algona since 2015, was pronounced dead at Kossuth Regional Health Center in Algona. The officer's death left the quiet Kossuth County community of 5,300 stunned. Rickey was arrested later that night in southern Minnesota and charged with first-degree murder. Cram's funeral was conducted by Pastor Linda Cole and Deacon David Penton. Algona Police Chief Bo Miller said Cram was always there to help others in need, whether that be fellow officers, victims, family, or strangers. Quote, when I speak his name, what comes to me is family, honor, integrity, hardworking, officer, and friend, Miller said. Miller said the first time he met at the police station with Cram, who was also a farmer, he could smell cattle or hog, but wasn't completely sure it was coming from Cram's clothing. Quote, as I walked by, I was able to confirm it was the smell, Miller said. Kevin didn't care much about his clothes. He cared about a life of service, unquote. Cram loved hunting, fishing, and simply being outdoors with his children, Archer, Winston, and Ira. He also had a passion for working on tractors and guns, both old and new. Miller said Cram was very proud of his chickens and messaged Miller multiple articles about Iowa blue chickens. Miller didn't read them until after Cram's death. Quote, "They are pretty great chickens," he said, "and when Kevin loved something, there was no questioning that love," unquote. Miller went on to say that he met with Cram's wife, Laura, in his office prior to writing his speech for the funeral. She stood up and was about to leave when Miller asked her if there were anything in particular she wanted him to say. Quote, "If you want to talk about eating opossums, that's fine," Laura said. Cram always talked about eating opossums and other non-traditional wildlife, Miller said. He would forward recipes for things like opossum pie and raccoon stew. Miller never really believed he ate those things, but now he's not so sure. He thought it was a tactic to prevent people from stealing his food at work. Quote, "If there were food that had Cram on it, you did not want to eat that food. It might be some kind of mystery meat," Miller said jokingly. Miller finished by telling a brief story about running his dog, as he does every morning. He passed by a farm and could smell the cattle right away, reminding him of the first time he met Cram. Quote, "I smiled and got pretty emotional by myself. I never thought that smell could make me cry," Miller said. Former Algona Police Chief Kendall Powles asked who Cram really was. Quote, "Many of you would describe him as a public servant, a police officer, a criminal investigator, a husband, father, son, and brother. But that's not really who he is. That's what he is," Paul said. He described Cram as quiet, kind, respectful, caring, dedicated, helpful, friendly, and honest. Penton, who also served with Cram as Algona's ambulance director, said he worked with him in multiple ways, was a friend, and can confirm the opossum stories. Quote, "If it's warm enough, you have enough garlic and butter, it tastes like lobster," he said. Penton also told a story about a 12-year-old Cram flirting with a waitress named Summer. When she came back to the table, she asked him what his favorite season was, and he replied, "Deer season." Cram also had an interesting first meeting with Laura's first son, Archer, when they met. Quote, "The first time he met Archer, Archer told him that he was Batman. But you can call me Archer," Penton said. Quote, "I don't know about you, but you have to be brave to date Batman's mom," unquote. He was known for putting his family's needs above his own, Penton said. He was also found reading bedtime stories to them inside his squad car. Quote, "He never turned the dad off. He never turned the husband off," Penton said. Quote, "What an incredible man," unquote. Now, let's turn to the sports section. First, we have a story from the junior college volleyball. Hawkeye sweeps NIAC, and it begins with a photograph of a joyful Hawkeye Community College girls volleyball team celebrating after scoring against North Iowa Area Community College on Thursday in Waterloo. Dateline's Waterloo. Hawkeye Community College defeated the North Iowa Area Community College, NIAC, in Iowa Community College Athletic Conference volleyball action on Thursday. Ranked number 15 in the NJCAA Division II Top 25, the Red Tails, 13-4 and 4-1 in ICCAC, took down the Trojans, 8-14 and 0-5 in ICCAC, in a sweep, 25-20, 25-13, 25-20, handing NIAC its seventh consecutive loss. Hawkeye head coach Tyann Wolfensberger took both positives and negatives from the win, though she noted the Red Tails' offense stole the show. Quote, "They came out a little slow, but they picked it up," Wolfensberger said. "Offensively, we did some really great things. We ran a rotational defense, which works really well against NIAC, so they did a really good job with that. Service receive could have improved a little, but there was some highlights in there. But offensively, I think we did really well, unquote. As Wolfensperger noted, Hawkeye opened the night slowly, falling behind 5-1 in the first set as the Trojans reeled off a 4-point run to get out to the sizable advantage. Freshman Allison Barras, a Belmont-Clem alum, halted the run with a strong cross-court kill. Although its run ended, NIAC continued to keep the Hawkeye at arm's length, getting out to a 14-11 advantage later in the set. A double hit against NIAC sparked a Red Tails rally, however, as Hawkeye scored 6 of the next 7 points to jump out to a 17-15 lead. After the NIAC point cut the lead to 17-16, Hawkeye managed a 6-point run to take a 23-17 lead and cruise to the 20-25 win in set 1. In set 2, the Red Tails, powered by a pair of kills from both Devon Van Dyke and Piper McCarville, took 7 of the first 8 points to leap out to a 7-1 lead, forcing a NIAC timeout. The timeout did not work with the Trojans' favor, however, as Hawkeye went on a 7-2 run out of the stoppage. A big sequence from Cedar Falls alum Lauren Lilly helped elongate the surge, as the freshman got up for 2 blocks and the kill to give Hawkeyes an 11-3 lead. Leading 14-3, Hawkeye outscored NIAC 11-10 down the stretch to steal the win and take a 2-0 lead in the match. Much like the first set, Hawkeye fell behind in the set 3 as NIAC scored the first 5 points of the match. Trailing 5-0, the Red Tails found their offense rhythm once more and whittled down the Trojans' lead to 8-4, before rattling off 4 consecutive points to tie the match at 8-8. After trading the next 14 points evenly to a 15-15 tie, the Hawkeyes managed to pull away with a 5-point run and outscored the Trojans 10-5 over the final 15 points of the match. Wolfensperger highlighted unforced errors, specifically serve-receive, as the cause for the Red Tails' struggles in falling behind early in sets 1 and 3, but felt her team showed resiliency in finding wins. Quote, "We just had a few breakdowns in there, and a few plays did not go our way," Wolfensperger said. "So we just had to fight back on some of those points." College football. In looking ahead at Iowa's next game, Ferentz looks back. Story written by Ethan Petrick. Dateline, Iowa City. Kirk Ferentz looked back to 2009 when asked about Iowa's upcoming matchup on the road against number 7 Penn State. The number 24 Hawkeyes head coach responded with a reflection on his 11th season at the helm in Iowa City when his Hawkeyes, led by junior quarterback Ricky Stanzi, defeated number 5 Penn State in Ferentz's 5th trip to Beaver Stadium with Iowa. A true Iowa win. The Hawkeyes trailed 10-5 at halftime, but eked out a win with 16 points in the fourth quarter, including a blocked punt by Adrian Claiborne, which he returned for a touchdown, to win 21-10. The Hawkeyes put up 298 total yards of offense and won the turnover battle with a +2 differential. Quote, "That was a good football team that we had, and those guys hung tough," Ferentz said. Quote, "You find a way. You make a couple plays. You never know how it's going to come, where it's coming from. Claiborne's thing? It was one guy's outstanding effort." Quote, "It is funny how that works sometimes, too. Guys like that just spark a team, and then after that, we knew we had a little different demeanor the rest of the day," unquote. Ferentz recalls that 2009 when, despite 9 meetings with Penn State and 4 trips to Beaver Stadium since, because it was the last time the Hawkeyes faced the Nittany Lions during their vaunted whiteout game, describing it as a great college football environment and a great challenge for the Hawkeyes, Ferens looks to 2009 as a reference to what Iowa can expect from a sold-out crowd of 100,000 people clad in all white in State College, Pennsylvania, on Saturday. Quote, "We always talk about getting off to a good start, especially on the road. Try to take the crowd out of it," Ferens said. Quote, "We did just the exact opposite of that in 09. Next thing you know, it's 17-0. We are looking up, and the place is going crazy. To play in a raucous environment like that, it is good to be the home team, for sure." Quote, "You have no choice. You have to try and keep your composure. It is easier said than done, because it is easy to buckle," unquote. Ferens added that the Hawkeyes needed to find a way to generate their own energy against the Nittany Lions, a la Claiborne's blocked punt, and use it to silence the crowd. Quote, "When you are playing a team as talented as these guys are, as good as they are, as well coached as they are, they are going to be some lows," Ferens said. Quote, "Hopefully we create some highs, but there's going to be some lows. You just have to keep playing," unquote. In spite of the daunting environment, Ferens noted the biggest challenge for his team remains their opponent. Ferens praised Penn State, describing their performance as expected in wins over West Virginia, Delaware, and Illinois, which were all decided by at least three scores. Quote, "Looking forward, we are playing, obviously, a good football team," Ferens said. "I think everybody expected Penn State to be an outstanding team, and after three games, that is certainly what it looks like watching them on film, watching them perform. They are really good, 3-0 and 1-0 in the Big Ten right now," unquote. According to Ferens, looking back to previous matchups with Penn State informs the present as much as looking back on their 2009 win. Quote, "As customary at Penn State, the next guys up do a great job," Ferens said. Quote, "That is what we are seeing on film," unquote. Ferens described Penn State's offense as pretty much what it has looked like for some time, which he called pretty impressive. Quote, "Offensively, they run the ball, throw the ball, do both of them very well," Ferens said. "Basically, two personnel groups. But either way, they run it effectively, they throw it effectively. They have good players out wide, two really good tight ends, two good backs. The young quarterback has done a great job running things for them and looks very composed back there. Their offensive line is big, strong, and very experienced," unquote. Defensively, in the second year of defensive coordinator Manny Diaz, the Nittany Lions deploy an aggressive approach manned by supreme athletes, according to Ferens. Quote, "They have been playing great defense," Ferens said. "They give up 11 points a game. Really athletic guys at every position. They got a lot of really good players, and they are very, very active and very dangerous because of their athleticism. The Nittany Lions rank 16th in the nation in total defense through 3 weeks, allowing just 267.3 yards per game. In terms of scoring, Penn State has allowed just 11.67 points per game in the first 3 weeks, ranking 13th in scoring defense." Ferens added that Penn State demonstrates an evident carryover from 11-2 season in 2022, which ended with a Rose Bowl victory over number 7, Utah. On Tuesday, Ferens said running backs Jason Patterson and Caleb Johnson will miss Saturday's game due to injury, in addition to the tight end Luke Lakey. Kickoff on Saturday is slated for 6:40 p.m. The game will be broadcast on CBS for television audiences and the Hawkeye Radio Network for radio audiences. So listeners, on Saturday, if you're listening to radio, tune in to KWAY, which is 99.3 FM. On TV, it'll be on the CBS network. College women's soccer, UNI beats Illinois-Chicago in bounce-back win. Dateline Cedar Falls. Northern Iowa held on and pulled out a win on Thursday, besting the University of Illinois-Chicago Flames 1-0 in Missouri Valley Conference action Thursday after a white-knuckle first half. The win comes after a 2-1 loss to Drake in the beginning of the Missouri Valley Conference play, their first loss of the season. Head coach Bruce Erickson says this keeps them on the right track as they prepare for the rest of the season. Quote, "I thought it was a good bounce back in the end," Erickson said. Quote, "That's a big win because UIC is a good team. Now, our goal is to be 1-0 every game, and with the Southern Illinois coming in, we've got to be 1-0. We've got to look to be 1-0. So, yeah, good result," unquote. The wind was in the Panthers' faces at the beginning of the game, giving an edge to UIC. This resulted in 9 shots on goal for the Flames to UNI's 2. However, Caitlin Richards was successful in holding the line for them with 4 saves in the first half. According to Richards, communication with the other defenders in the back was a key factor in her clutch goalkeeping, as was maintaining engagement throughout the half. Quote, "I think it's mainly for us communication and keeping connected as a back four, and I think they're, but it's basically playing in the game," Richards said. "We may not have the ball the whole time, but it's important that I stay engaged and everyone else stays engaged with at least communicating, because when I communicate, I make the saves, because I'm staying engaged," unquote. In the second half, the advantage was on the Panthers, with the goals switched. UNI made 8 shots, and 59 minutes and 17 seconds into the game, Maddie Istas broke through the only goal of the game. From there, the Panthers shored up defense and kept the Flames from tying it up, securing the win. Quote, "I'm super excited about it. I think it was a good win," Istas said. "I think we're off to a good start in the conference, and I think it's a good way to keep going strong. Great finish, great sequence. We got a big goal from her, and she was deserving," Erickson said. "I love the finish, so it was awesome," unquote. The win improves their record to 8-1-1 for the season. UNI hosts the University of Southern Illinois on Sunday at noon. Officials and veterans celebrate new VAA outpatient clinic opening Monday in Waterloo. Story filed by Andy Malone. Dateline Waterloo. Tim and Felina Houts have connections to both the future and former uses of a massive building off Progress and University Avenues. One of Cedar Falls couple's sons used to work at the old Hy-Vee grocery store at 4000 University Avenue. Another son serves in the Army and is a veteran like his father, who served in the Navy from 1970 to 1974, including during the Vietnam War. On Monday, a 21,000-square-foot area on the eastern side of the facility will open as a Veterans Affairs outpatient clinic. Tim Houts will be among at least 4,200 veterans from the Cedar Valley and greater northeast Iowa region to benefit from the new facility that is more than twice the size of the clinic it's replacing, at 945 Tower Park Drive. The enhanced clinic will offer a greater number of services overall, closer to the veterans' homes. Felina Houts noted how she sent a photo of the clinic to her one son, letting him know, quote, "This doesn't look like Hy-Vee anymore," unquote. And Tim Houts added how it is much closer to his home than the other one in Waterloo, and how he'd even have to go to Iowa City for services relating to his hearing aid. Quote, "They just had an audiology technician," he said. "Now he and others will have access to an audiologist, an expert in hearing." The Houts were among nearly 100 people, many of them veterans, to gather for remarks and a ribbon cutting at the new clinic on Thursday afternoon. The celebration and tour also included a flag-raising ceremony led by the University of Northern Iowa Reserve Officers Training Corps members. Clinic hours will be 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. And here we have a photograph of the front entrance to the VA Department of Veterans Affairs outpatient clinic, and you can see a drop-off area for patients and a big sign at the top in blue and white. The VA satellite locations move every 10 to 20 years due to outgrowing spaces as they add more services. The new clinic will offer primary care, mental health, physical therapy, audiology, a pharmacist, and a dietitian, as well as radiology, lab, women's treatment, telehealth, and other social services. Optometry will be offered in the near future. About 40 people will work out of the massive facility with 18 primary care rooms. That is part of about 30 treatment and exam rooms spanning the various specialties and 60 to 70 estimated spaces with bright colors and taller ceilings. Quote, over time, we'd like to still see the addition of chiropractic care, home-based primary care, and then additional mental health services, Waterloo Clinical Manager Kathy Cromer told those in attendance. Also on site will be public contact representatives to help with the various veteran claims, benefits, and forms as part of the community-based outpatient clinic initiative, helping reach more rural veterans and the deceased veterans' widows and children. Quote, the space will give us more room to expand, more opportunities to grow, and a better position to engage the healthcare needs of our patients for years to come, enrolling more veterans who will choose the VA for their health care, said Heath Strick, Associate Director for Operations of the Iowa City VA Healthcare System. Back in 2021, the building's landlord, Highland Enterprises, acquired the property with the 65,000-square-foot building from Hy-Vee for $1.6 million. Chris Williams, a partner, says the remaining 44,000 square feet has not yet been leased, but noted how the business is interested in retail and medical users. The investors have been involved in different VA facilities and redevelopment projects throughout the Midwest, including the outpatient clinic in Ottumwa, according to Williams. Downtown Waterloo dealership employee detains intruder at gunpoint. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man is behind bars after he was allegedly caught inside a car from a dealership after hours and then attacked an employee with a screwdriver. The employee drew his pistol and detained David Hocking, 51, until police arrived and arrested him on charges of first-degree robbery, possession of burglary tools, and trespassing. Bond was set at $32,000. According to court records, the worker at Liberty Car Company noticed Hocking in the driver's seat of a vehicle parked at the dealership's lot at 407 East Mullen Avenue around 9:30 p.m. on Tuesday. Hocking was allegedly working the ignition, and when the employee confronted him, Hocking exited the vehicle and tried to stab him with a screwdriver. The worker drew his firearm. Hocking began to run, and the employee wrestled with him until officers showed up, court records state. Hocking is also awaiting trial for a September 16th incident where he allegedly failed to pay for $22 worth of food at Newton's Cafe, a September 6th incident where he allegedly damaged an elevator door at the Hotel President, and a February 2022 incident where he was entering vehicles parked at Reedy's Auto Sales on Commercial Street. He is also awaiting trial for a May 2022 incident where he rode a bike to a Birmingham Avenue business claiming to be the Waterloo police chief. When he was approached by police officers, he claimed to be the Blackhawk County Sheriff running an internal affairs investigation, according to court records. And now, listeners, we just want to take a minute to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 22nd, and you're listening on IRIS, I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, this announcement.
Imagine someone hiding a gambling problem. How exhausting it must be. Seeing the losses pile up and feeling powerless to control it. Now imagine it's someone you love, your spouse, your child, your friend. Talk to them to understand where they're coming from. Because anyone can have a gambling problem. They just need help getting their life back. Call 1-800-BETS-OFF to get help for them and you.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from the New York Times, written by Jessica Gross, The Hope at the Bottom of the Child Care Cliff. I had a fantasy that after the child care disaster of the past couple of years, there might be a more permanent federal-level change in financial support for the sector. It did feel, for a little while, as if politicians were finally paying attention to the decades-long problem. In September of 2021, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said, quote, "Child care is a textbook example of a broken market," unquote, one that really isn't working for caregivers, parents, or children. That year, Congress passed the American Rescue Plan Act, which provided funding to help stabilize the child care market, which at the time was in something of a free fall. 2 years later, after Yellen's searing remarks, we're about to fall off a child care cliff, as $24 billion allocated for child care grants is set to expire at the end of this month. As the Century Foundation puts it, quote, "When these resources swiftly and suddenly disappear, this funding cliff will once again place the sector in danger, as it will be forced to contract, shedding caregivers and care slots in a cascade that will not only upend millions of families' child care arrangements, but also hurt regional economies," unquote. Century estimates that over 3 million children could lose their child care spots, and though it certainly won't happen overnight, it could be a kind of slow-rolling financial mess for many parents and providers. Pointing out that the current state of child care causes many parents to feel broke and anxious doesn't seem to make that much of a difference. Whenever I write about this, the feedback I get is that people shouldn't have kids they can't afford in the first place, and that it's not the government's job to help them with their luxury lifestyle choices. I'm paraphrasing. Talking about the strain that it puts on child care providers, who may have to raise tuition, cut staff wages and benefits, and serve fewer children after the funding stops, according to an analysis by my newsroom colleagues, doesn't seem to move the needle either. Some people don't seem to be convinced that the health and well-being of our nation's children should be a collective priority. So I called Catherine Ann Edwards, an economist and economic policy consultant, to see if there's an argument that might change people's minds about the utter necessity of more robust government child care funding. Or should I lose all hope in the possibility of a shift in the way that child care is thought about, discussed, and sustained in the United States? Edwards told me she thinks, ultimately, we'll see better funding for child care, and she somewhat cheekily described the argument for that to me as, quote, "Why you should want child care even if you hate women and their children," unquote. We might not see change before the funding runs out this month, but in the longer term, quote, "Two things are going to force Congress's hand, whether they like it or not," unquote, Edwards explained. "The first is that U.S. labor force participation is midway through a historic decline, and unless Congress wants to increase immigration on an order of magnitude of 3 to 5, they need more workers domestically, which means they need women to work more," unquote. This is mostly because baby boomers are retiring, and though Edwards says we can get them to work a few more years around the margins, quote, "we cannot turn back the tide," unquote. There are simply not enough millennials to make up for it by the numbers, because prime-age women's labor force participation is low. In Edwards phrasing it, quote, "has been frozen in time for 25 years, unquote. When you see headlines about how we're at all-time highs for women labor force participation, Edwards suggests that's really misleading. When you look at the actual level of increase since the 1990s, labor force participation among women has barely budged, and without a policy shift, we shouldn't expect it to go up much in the coming years. The second thing that could force Congress to act on child care is that the birth rate is on the decline in the United States, Edwards said. It has been since the Great Recession, and though there was a slight uptick in the birth rate in 2021, it plateaued in 2022. There aren't enough babies to make up for the number of workers retiring and the number of working adults needed to keep Social Security solvent. Without legislative action, the Peter G. Peterson Foundation has projected that after 2034, Social Security benefits may need to be reduced by 20%. Quote, at some point, you have to address the thing that sits at the nexus of fertility declines and labor force participation, Edwards said. The cost of child care, quote, is the number one reason that parents with children currently say they don't have another kid. And it's the reason many women are pushed out of the workforce. As Edwards has noted, a lack of child care will have a ripple effect on a number of professions, including nursing and teaching, which are heavily female workforces and are already facing labor shortages. Maybe you don't have school-age kids and don't intend to, and therefore teacher shortages don't move you. Maybe you just don't care at all that much about kids. But it's a potential negative for everyone when nurses are in short supply. Some states, both red and blue, are already stepping in where the federal government is falling short, said Julie Cashin, a senior fellow at Century. Quote, we've seen that business disruptions due to child care disruptions can have a huge impact on productivity, she said. So if the federal government doesn't make changes to child care funding this year, states may have no choice but to allocate more of their budgets to filling the gaps. I wish that arguments about how all children deserve safe care in environments in which they can flourish would sway more people. I wish more people simply thought of a child care as something that benefits the nation as a whole. But as those arguments repeatedly founder, maybe the cold economic case for fixing this failed market will work. Because the gerontocracy might not care so much about children, but they sure do care about Social Security. Next, we have an opinion that was written in the Storm Lake Times Pilot by the editor Art Cullen, and it is titled, New Long Overdue Efforts to Reform Federal Commodity Checkoffs. And it begins with a photograph of a farmer pulling a planter, and it looks like 32 rows on that planter. And with all of those rows lined up with their feeders and the long scratching rods on each end, it makes the big tractor in front look small. And I just have a mental picture of what the field would look like if I tried to turn that rig around even one time at the end of the row. It's been years since this weekly effort has used any time, muscle, or brain cells to write, or frankly, even care about any of the 21 costly, largely ineffective, and virtually bulletproof federal commodity checkoff programs. The reason is simple. In 3 decades of reporting on congressionally chartered federal checkoffs, oftentimes documenting illegal use of farmer and rancher money for lavish travel, spying on fellow farm groups, and funding outlawed political activities, rare is the checkoff, checkoff employee, or checkoff farmer, director, held accountable for any of the questionable activities or the checkoff's rock-bottom performances since the late 1980s. In fact, the third column I ever wrote, way back in June of 1993, outlined how an audit of the not-yet-completely-in-place federal soybean checkoff discovered $405,219 of questionable costs, which the ASA, its main contractor, the American Soybean Association, quote, had charged USB, the newly formed checkoff's United Soybean Board. And I added, quote, the sum could be larger because the audit traced only 60% of USB's money at ASA, unquote. Those two observations, disputed costs and incomplete audits, would become themes of many columns over the next 30 years. Another favorite was the clear failure of most checkoffs to boost consumer demand, the key selling point that every checkoff pusher swore would raise farm prices. For example, a May 1998 column revealed that the federal dairy checkoff had spent about $2.5 billion in dairy promotion money from 1987 to 1996, even as, quote, U.S. milk and dairy product consumption dropped a solid 4%, unquote. The column went on to outline how U.S. cattle producers had dumped $874 million into their beef checkoff between 1986 and 1996, as American, quote, per capita beef consumption dropped by 4.5 pounds, and consumers cut beef expenditures by $8 billion. It also showed how the pork checkoff and its, quote, the other white meat campaign, had spent $417 million in non-refundable checkoff cash to raise per capita pork consumption a tiny 0.4 pounds from 45.6 pounds in the 1986 to 46 pounds in 1997. That rounding error increase in pork consumption cost rural America more than the checkoff millions, though. During that same decade, 60% of producers, or more than 200,000, left the pork industry, unquote. Given this early awful performance of federally charted checkoffs, the following facts won't come as breaking news. Over the subsequent 25 years, federal checkoffs, spending an estimated $900 million to $1 billion a year on generic commodity advertising, were even less effective. For example, after an estimated $30 to $35 billion, that's billion with a B, in collective ag commodity checkoff spending since 1987, American per capita consumption of fluid milk is one half today what it was 40 years ago. Beef has fallen from 73.7 pounds per year to 57.4 pounds, and pork remains flat, 48.8 pounds in 1987, and now only 50 pounds. Meanwhile, U.S. per capita consumption of chicken increased from 56.6 pounds in 1987 to an estimated 101.8 pounds in 2023, or nearly double over the same period. And here's the too-funny-to-be-funny part about the rise, the all-conquering chicken. It became what's for dinner by not spending checkoff billions to tell Americans it was the original white meat, or ask them if they got chicken. In fact, chicken didn't put even one of its eggs in a costly producer-funded checkoff basket because chicken doesn't have a state or federal checkoff. Instead, it seized the American dinner plate by investing in quality and convenience while avoiding every checkoff fight. Now, a long-overdue new checkoff reform effort is underway in Congress. It's led by Utah Republican Mike Lee and Democrat and vegan Cory Booker of New Jersey, who say reform is needed because of the, quote, unlawful use of checkoff program funds that benefit some agricultural producers while harming others, unquote. Most of the groups that have been deeply enriched by federal checkoffs, like the Soybean Gang, the National Pork Producers Council, the National Milk Producers Federation, and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, are fighting all reforms. Why? Because commodity checkoffs are really about gravy, and this gravy train has been running on time for 35 years. And now we have young voters are frustrated. They're staying engaged out of sheer self-defense. This written by Charles M. Blow of the New York Times. A Pew Research Center report released this week called Americans' Views of Our Politics Dismal. That might be too kind a word. On metric after metric, the report ticked through markers of our persistent pessimism. In 1994, it says, quote, just 6%, unquote, of Americans viewed both political parties negatively. That number has now more than quadrupled to 28%. The percentage who believe our political system is working extremely or very well is at just 4%. And on many measures, younger people are the most frustrated and supportive of disruptive change as a remedy. Younger voters recognize that our political system is broken, and they have little nostalgia about a less broken time. They have almost no memory of an era when government was less partisan and less gridlocked. Their instincts are to fix the system they've inherited, not to wind back the clock to a yesteryear. According to Pew, among American adults under 30, 70% favor having a national popular vote for president, 58% favor expansion of the Supreme Court, 44% favor expansion of the House of Representatives, and 45% favor amending the Constitution to change the way representation in the Senate is apportioned, numbers higher than their older counterparts, particularly those over 50. But the American political system wasn't built to make radical change easy. Yes, our political system needs a major overhaul, but such an overhaul is almost inconceivable given current political constraints. This can be a bracing reality when youthful idealism crashes into it. The knot that the country finds itself in may be one reason Pew found that younger voters are the least likely to believe that voting can have at least some effect on the country's future direction. And yet, according to a poll this spring of 18 to 29-year-olds by the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School, they're still engaged. As John Della Volpe, director of polling at the Institute and author of Fight, How Gen Z is Channeling Their Fear and Passion to Save America, unquote, put it, quote, "From the midterms through the recent Wisconsin Supreme Court election, we are seeing young Americans increasingly motivated to engage in politics out of sheer self-defense and a responsibility to fight for those even more vulnerable than themselves," unquote. This defensive posture is understandable when you think about the political era in which these younger voters came of age, a dizzying period of dysfunction, calamity, and activism. Among voters 30 to 49, the oldest were in their 20s on September 11, 2001. The events of that day would roll into America's longest war, 20 years in Afghanistan. Those voters would see the hopefulness around the election of Barack Obama as president, but also the extreme backlash to his election that would culminate in the election of Donald Trump, Obama's intellectual and moral antithesis. Voters 18 to 29 ranged from their preteen years to their early 20s when Trump was elected in 2016. Only the oldest of them were eligible to vote at the time. The Trump years saw a president who has been accused of sexual assault, was openly hostile to minorities and disdainful of civil rights protests, and lied incessantly as those supporting him repeatedly excused or covered up for him. The oldest of this group were in their late teens when Trayvon Martin was killed in 2012, so they lived the birth and rise of Black Lives Matter and are now living the backlash to it. The Trump years exposed the inability, the ineptitude, of our system to hold leaders accountable and ended with an attempt to overturn an election and a storming of the Capitol. Those years also saw a surge in mass shootings and warnings about the effects of climate change growing more dire, two issues that have become important to young voters. The overturning of Roe v. Wade was the clincher. It's no wonder that younger voters are so frustrated and so thirsty for change, and they spare no one in pursuing it. While younger voters are more likely to have a favorable view of Democrats than of Republicans, they're also more likely than the older generations to have unfavorable views of both parties. More than half of Americans under 30 said it is usually the case that none of the candidates running for political office in recent years represent their views well. This all hints at a profound frustration with a lack of results, that professionalization of politics and incrementalism and intransigence. And yet this frustrated army of voters could still have a major impact in 2024. The Brookings Institute did the math on how important this voting bloc will be. And here we have the quote from the Brookings Institution. According to our projections, based on U.S. Census Bureau estimates, if Americans under 45, plurals, and millennials vote at the same rate as they did in the 2020 presidential election, they will represent more than one-third, 37%, of the 2024 electorate. If that generational cohort's contribution to the electorate in the next year's presidential general election is the same as its contribution to the U.S. voting age population, it will comprise nearly half, 49%, of the vote on November 5, 2024. In recent elections, younger voters have been voting nearly 2-to-1 for Democrats, and the Republican Party may be pushing more of that group in the direction as the party digs in its heels on social positions unpopular with them. But it's a sad state of affairs that our current political system starves young people of hope and optimism, and instead forces them to cast their ballots as if under existential threat, regardless of which party benefits. Now, let's turn back to local news from the Courier. All In Grocers store to celebrate grand opening in Waterloo on October 3rd. Dateline Waterloo. The grand opening of All In Grocers and Grandma's Hands restaurant is set for noon on October 3rd. A ribbon cutting will be held at the store location, 221 Franklin Street. Commemorative grocery bags will be offered to attendees along with food samples from the new restaurant. The 28,000 square foot development also includes clean laundry and the Willie Mae Wright Community Center, named after the Waterloo civil rights icon. The center will not only host cooking, math, science, and history classes, but serve as a satellite office of the 1619 Freedom School, an after-school program focused on literacy founded by the Nicole Hannah Jones, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from Waterloo. And here we have a photograph showing the entrance to the building, and there's a big sign at the top says, All In Grocers. The center will also include space for Road Home, a nonprofit fiscally sponsored by the American Family Insurance Institute for Corporate and Social Impact, that will provide re-entry services to the formerly incarcerated. The project received help from the Rochelle Capital IFF, a nonprofit community development financial institution, the American Family Insurance Institute, True Stage Foundation, formerly known as CUNA Mutual, and Self-Help Credit Union. The City of Waterloo has also provided support for All In Grocers. More information can be found at allingrocers.com. Lunar Magic, Mid-Autumn Moon Festival set at Hearst Center for the Arts. Story filed by Melody Parker. Dateline Cedar Falls. A celebration of the moon will usher in fall at the Hearst Center for the Arts. The Mid-Autumn Moon Festival is from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday at the center, 304 West Surly Boulevard, in collaboration with the University of Northern Iowa's International Engagement Office. Participants will paint lanterns, make and enjoy moon cakes, and other activities, said Sherry Huber-Odding, Hearst Program Coordinator. The event is free and open to the public. Quote, we'll hang up the lanterns on the patio and people can take pictures, then take home their lanterns. UNI international students will bring food to share, and mooncakes are a traditional part of moon festivals, she explained. Many Asian cultures celebrate moon festivals during the harvest season, and mooncakes, considered a delicacy, are made, shared, and eaten. Lanterns symbolize lighting a path to prosperity and good fortune. Asian students represent a large portion of UNI's International Student Program, said Ava Dietrich, IEO Programming Coordinator. This will be the university's third Moon Festival and the first to take place at the Hearst Center. Quote, "The Hearst has been amazing when it comes to collaboration, offering us a space in the community that we can utilize with our international students," she explained. In 2022, Holi Festival, a significant Hindu celebration, was the first event in the partnership. Corey Herless, City of Cedar Falls Cultural Program Supervisor, said the Hearst Center Director said the collaboration has been, quote, "a natural fit to deliver the community, providing programming and activities for the community to promote cultural awareness," unquote. This partnership encourages interaction between students and community members. Quote, "That's especially important for our students. The Cedar Valley is a surprisingly diverse community, and we want to take advantage of that and show the community what an amazing, vibrant, and enthusiastic international community we have at UNI," said Dietrich. International Education Week is November 13th through the 17th. IEO will host a Taste of Culture food fair from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., that's November 14th, in the Mocker Union. Activities and performances will take place, and UNI Catering will provide a range of cultural dishes. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, September 22nd. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of today's reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state of Iowa that we read. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.